May it please the Court. Operas begin with an overture, and although I'm not going to sing today, my overture is a decision tree to let us know just where this case is going to develop during this argument. Are the documents in question here a record as defined by the statute? If they're not, the case is over.
Mr. Schaefer, before we get to any of the merits, I have some preliminary questions. The first question is, I don't understand how the plaintiffs in this lawsuit have standing. Why is there an Article III case or controversy between these two state actors about the access by a deceased person who does not appear to be a party?
Your Honor, did you mean the plaintiff or the defendant having standing? We are the
in federal litigation, it's the plaintiff who needs standing. But the court has to assure itself that the plaintiff has standing, or there's no case or controversy.
Well, Your Honor, I believe they are a federally mandated or state-created agency that is given authority to conduct investigations of patient abuse.
No, that's not the question of standing. The question of standing is whether there is injury in fact caused by the adverse party and redressable by a judicial decision. Those are the three components of standing. And, of course, the first of those at the moment is injury in fact. Do we have injury in fact suffered by the plaintiff?
The plaintiff being the IPAS, or the patient, or the Protection Advocacy Agency, an injury in the sense that they've been denied access, which they believe they're entitled to under the statute. I believe it's probably statutorily.
Not having things not happen that you believe is not injury. If it were, there would be everybody would have standing all the time because people litigate only when they care about the outcome. The question is there any injury? Now, you may think it's unjust for me to ask you this question, but assuring that the court has subject matter jurisdiction is an important duty of every lawyer for every party.
Your Honor, I did not raise that point.
I understand that, but as I say, it is a duty of every lawyer for every party to consider subject matter jurisdiction.
I agree, Your Honor, and I regret that I'm unable to assist the court on that inquiry at this time.
Mm-hmm. Next question I have about what this case is doing here is whether plaintiff has a private right of action. Now, obviously, I'll be asking this of your opponents as well, but I don't understand how this case gets here. The statute involved appears to set requirements for federal funding of a state agency. And the Supreme Court has been pretty clear, most recently in the unanimous opinion in Bruner against Iowa Republican Party, that there is no private right of action of private parties to enforce funding limitations. So what are we doing here?
Your Honor, there's been at least four other circuits that have addressed litigation brought by these patient advocacy, and that is certainly affecting this agency, a question that has never been raised in this context involving access to records. There have been other places where it's been raised, but certainly not pertinent or similar cases these.
You haven't answered my question. I'm not interested in whether it's been raised in other circuits. I'm interested in the answer to my question. That is, how is it, if at all, that the plaintiffs have a private right of action, given that this is a conditional funding statute, and the Supreme Court says there's no private right of action to enforce the conditions in such statutes?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I would think that this is not a private right of action involved here. This is a state agency that has been created federal grants to pursue various activities, and where statute grants them a right to proceed, I did not go past any further questions of standing.
Standing wasn't addressed in our opinion in 2006 in the state of Wisconsin case of public instruction, was it? The standing or federal question issue?
I'm not aware of that case, Your Honor.
So the four circuits who have addressed it have not addressed the issue of whether this is actually a funding scheme, a funding statute, as opposed to a statute that has a private right of action?
That's correct, Your Honor. I do, in another context, recall where a 1983 action was brought by a P&A against the state, and I believe the Seventh Circuit declined to see standing there. So if the records in question are a record, then we must determine whether or not the parents of this hospitalized person are legal representatives under the statute as it's defined and further interpreted by the administrative agency. And if it is not, if they are not a legal representative under by interpretation, then have the constitutional rights of the parents of this patient been declined by invasion of their privacy and the right to be heard on whether or not the records of the patient should be released to this investigative agency?
Well, if you can get over the big hurdle that has been addressed regarding the standing and the statutory scheme, why would the parents who do not have a minor child but rather have an adult child that they simply seem to be involved with within this child's life when he was alive, why would that give them this ability to seek these records when all of the cases and much of the presentation that you've made in your briefs focuses on a parent's right to protect a minor child, which is when that right is usually established?
In the normal world, majority-minority is an important issue to determine the parent's role vis-a-vis their child. But when we're in the mental health area, that line is not so clearly drawn. In fact, the McCurdy case that I cited in my brief from the Third Circuit actually relied on the Bell decision from this circuit, which, and they stated, a constitutional line based solely on age cannot be drawn. So people in mental hospitals are there for a reason. Incapable to make their way in society for some reason or other. And in this case, although the patient was only with us for 6 days, the parents were involved, and then, as you know, she was ultimately transferred to a medical hospital. One thing I'd like to point out, too, since there's no Indiana judge on my panel, LaRue Carter Hospital is the flagship of the state's mental health system. That's a rehabilitatory hospital, or at least that is their goal. They're not dealing with lifelong type ailments that are organic or lack of intelligence or things like that, those type of afflictions. So,
actually, your answer to Judge Kendall's question brought out still another jurisdictional concern that I have. The bulk of your presentation, although you're representing the state and a hospital, the bulk of your presentation asserts the rights of the parents. But I don't understand how you can assert the rights of the parents. Only the parents can assert the rights of the parents, and they don't appear to be here.
They're not here, Your Honor. But I believe the physicians treating a patient have standing to represent the interests of the patient. And this is, I cited...
Some sort of parents patriae claim? You know how the Supreme Court has treated parents patriae claims in the absence of an express parents patriae statute.
Well, Your Honor...
It said there's no standing.
Well, and I'm not claiming parents patriae, Your Honor.
If you're not claiming parents patriae, and you don't have a statute authorizing the state to represent the interests of the parents, I don't understand how any of your arguments is properly presented.
Your Honor, we rely on the Danforth cases that arose in the reproductive health field, that a doctor does have the rights to...
You realize the Danforth case has been overruled by the Supreme Court.
Well, I believe Doe v. Bolton, the same principle is held.
Did the parents ever refuse to consent to turn over these records?
Your Honor, we do not even know whether they were ever contacted or whether a request was made by the P&A.
This is getting curiouser and curiouser. If you think their rights are at issue, why didn't you contact them?
Let's suppose,
because it's true, Indiana Protection and Advocacy Services asks for documents that you, that is the state or the hospital, believe concern the interests of the parents. Isn't the very first thing the hospital does is notify the parents?
Didn't happen, and to my knowledge, it didn't happen because the P&A did not ask us to contact them. This was a...
I don't care whether they wanted you to contact them. If somebody asked for records that you believe affect the parents' privacy interests, why don't you contact the parents?
Well, Your Honor, it didn't happen, and I don't run the hospital.
You may not run the hospital, but you are the lawyer in litigation, and you can tell them what they need to do.
Well, Your Honor, I was hired on this case after the lawsuit was filed. I'm not a regular deputy attorney general in a day-to-day situation with them. Plus, Your Honor, let's not forget that there's a real question whether there is a... whether these are in fact legal representatives. The Bell case, I think, clearly holds that age is not the line to determine whether or not someone has been emancipated to the point that they are free to make their own decisions or capable of making it. By limiting in the subsequent administrative interpretation, by limiting the term other legal representative, it was simply the same type of representatives that were already mentioned in the statute, namely court-appointed conservators and that like, I think missed the boat on exactly who can be a legal representative. And under Indiana law, parents of a minor child or a disabled person are qualified legal representatives. I think my time is waning here, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Ms. Dial.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Deborah Dial. I represent Appellee, Indiana Protection and Advocacy Services.
Well, as you can see, you've got an agenda. Which of the multiple jurisdictional questions would you like to tackle first? Standing might be logically antecedent.
Well, we're set up by the PAMI Act, and also Indiana statute establishes our agency to protect the rights of individuals.
Doesn't cut any ice. The question is, how are you injured? Right? Suppose a federal statute says, I authorize John Jones to vindicate the rights of everyone, everywhere.
Correct.
Does Jones have standing to vindicate Smith's rights? The answer is no. That's a statute that Congress can't enact. Congress can't say, I authorize Jones to go get advisory opinions about other people's rights. So So I'm trying to figure out, how is your client injured?
Well, we're injured, the agency itself. We're trying to follow our mandate, part of which is doing abuse and neglect investigations.
No, I'm still lost. Suppose the statute says John Jones is ordered to vindicate the rights of everyone else in the world, everywhere. There's still no standing because John Jones still isn't injured.
Well, our
Jones can't come in and say, I'm just trying to carry out my instruction to vindicate everybody else's rights.
Well, our injury is the resources that we've put in our incapability of following through with the abuse and neglect investigations. So we've probably since 2003 put a lot of resources behind trying to follow through and do this, and many of our investigations have come to a halt.
I must say, you don't get standing by sinking resources into the lawsuit and then saying, and if I'm not allowed to carry on, everything I've sunk into the lawsuit will be wasted. Because then everybody has standing to litigate about everything, and that's not the Supreme Court's view. There must be a concrete injury antecedent to the litigation. Well, let's move on.
Okay.
Is your client itself a state agency?
Correct. It's Indiana Protection and Advocacy Services.
Then I don't understand at all how it can sue, because this seems to be some species of 1983 litigation, and the Supreme Court has held, and according to the statute, it has to be brought by a person. Supreme Court has held that a state agency is not a person for purposes of 1983, and that means, first, that a state agency can't be a defendant. It also means that a state agency can't be a plaintiff. We held that in a case with the telling title, Illinois against Chicago.
Okay, except we're set up as a independent state agency.
You're obviously independent, or you wouldn't be suing them. You would work this out in private, like the Department of Treasury and the Department of Commerce do, rather than suing each other.
Correct.
But if a state agency is not a person, I don't understand how it can either be a plaintiff or a defendant under 1983.
Well, we didn't bring a 1983, kind of because we didn't want to get into that
analysis.
It's a straightforward request for an injunction for them to turn over the documents that we need to complete.
What is the source of federal jurisdiction as you see it?
It's PAMI is a federal statute, and that's what's being violated, so it's a federal question.
I don't understand. Well, you can see what my next question is. I don't understand how the statute has been violated. The language of 10805 and 10806 are conditions that a state has to meet to get federal money, right? And the Supreme Court has held in cases like Bruner against the Ohio Republican Party and Gonzaga University against Doe that statutes, conditional funding statutes, are to be enforced by the federal agency yanking the funds if the condition is not met, rather than by litigation. So, from about the third different perspective, why are we here? Is there any way your lawsuit is compatible with Bruner or Gonzaga University?
Right off the top of my head, I don't have an answer for you, except...
But it shouldn't be off the top of your head. This is the kind of thing you have to think about before filing the suit, rather than on your feet in the Court of Appeals.
Because I would have said... Standing was because of our injury and the resources that we've put behind trying to do our job, the actions of the defendant in keeping us from accomplishing that.
Well, does the statutory scheme implicate a substantial federal interest such that it would be properly before the court in spite of the fact that the sections that the Chief Justice pointed out are sections providing funding to the Indiana group as opposed to any other reason? Do you have a basis for arguing that a substantial federal interest might be implicated here?
We were created in the first place because Congress realized that many people who have various disabilities, and there are various funding sources, this along with the disability protection advocacy for individuals with disabilities, they realized there was a need to create some type of oversight agency, as it were, to protect the rights of these individuals throughout the states.
But the state is the one that's involved in creating those detailed rights. It's the state statutory scheme that is being reviewed, right? You, in fact, want us to interpret the state's scheme as opposed to a federal interpretation of that scheme, right?
Well, our state statute establishes our agency and also gives us some access rights, but we're also looking at what the PAMI allows us to do under establishing that as well. I'm not sure I've answered your question.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we're closer to getting a justiciable controversy. By the way, has the state returned its grant funds? This is in many ways an utterly bizarre situation. One state agency is suing another state agency. The second state agency got a federal grant by making certain promises. And in this litigation, the defendant state agency says the promises it made are all unconstitutional, which means it hasn't satisfied the conditions of the grant by its own admission, which means it should have returned the money, which you say it hasn't.
Correct. Well, we would disagree that there's a constitutional argument.
Well, it's made a constitutional argument. It may not have any authority to make it because the argument belongs to the parents.
Correct.
But the state has said, the other part of the state.
Yes.
The other part of the state has said that the promises it made to the federal government to get the funds are unconstitutional and not binding and won't be followed. And that does seem to mean that the state has conceded that it's not entitled to the money.
That one aspect of the state, I don't know that they speak for the entire state. We're also a state agency, and we haven't returned the money.
There seems to be a certain shortfall on thinking through the implications of one's positions here.
Because we're a state agency? Some PNAs are set up as private organizations. I don't know that overall that changes their standing. Probably I'm not giving you the answer that you want.
Just proceed with your argument.
Okay. One of the issues before the court is whether or not DMHA can deny our agency peer review documents. We assert that the PAMI statute would cover peer review documents as it creates the entitlement that we inspect and receive copies of in the course of conducting our abuse and neglect investigations, all records. We contend that the definitions in the PAMI Act are clear and unambiguous in granting us access to all records, and that would include the peer review documents. Four other U.S. District Circuit courts have also held that peer review documents are included within the access authority granted to IPAS under the PAMI Act. Specifically, the Third Circuit held that peer review reports certainly constitute records in the ordinary sense of the term. They also fall squarely within the definition provided in the Act. The Tenth Circuit further noted that all records of any individual, which is the quote from the statute, is quite broad, and it rejected any argument that all records refers only to patient records and not hospital records. Defendants also bring up a confidentiality issue in their denial of the peer review documents, and we would say that we have the obligation to treat these documents in the same manner that they would. So Indiana statute protects peer review documents, and to the extent that they have to protect that confidentiality, so do we. Another issue is whether or not parents are legal representatives for the purposes of the PAMI Act. I think it's pretty clear that to be a legal representative, one must be appointed by a state court or an agency empowered to do so. There must be reviews by the state court, and that individual, that appointed individual must have the authority to make basically health care decisions. And in this case, the parents were not appointed. The very purpose of the existence of a PNA system is to protect and advocate for the rights of individuals with disabilities. This includes investigations of abuse and neglect for individuals with mental illness when we have reason to believe that those individuals are being abused. We received a call from an employee at LaRue Carter, which is the psychiatric place where she was residing, and although she was moved to Wishard, the report came from LaRue about her time at LaRue. This court has acknowledged that PNA agencies have the duty to serve individuals with mental illness and other disabilities.
I hope you see that you're skating on particularly thin ice, because it sounds like you're raising the jurisdictional problem again. You're effectively describing your client as an ombudsman, someone who exists in order to protect or vindicate the rights of others. And that ombudsman may be a very valuable function to serve in society, but I should think that almost the definition of somebody who does not have a personal injury and therefore cannot sue in federal court is an ombudsman.
I think that the ombudsman, at least as they're set up in Indiana, just doesn't have the same kind of powers that we do. I think they don't have the power to sue. I mean, the PAMI Act gives us the power to seek various remedies, including litigation.
You're perfectly welcome to go to state court, which doesn't have to enforce the same case or controversy litigations as federal court.
And basically, we brought it because PAMI was a federal statute, so it's a federal question. In order to accomplish our duty, it's crucial to have access to records as Congress intended. Every record that IPASS has requested in this lawsuit falls under the purview of the PAMI's access mandate. And it's not simply enough to allow IPASS to inspect the records. The PAMI access specifically and without equivocation includes copies. This access authority stands against any concerns of confidentiality and also any concerns of individual privacy rights. And in fact, this court has stated confounding the agency in the name of an illusory concern for privacy defeats the agency's very important goal.
Just so I understand your argument about it being there is a federal question because there's a federal statute. What construction of this statute depends on federal law interpretation? What federal law are we interpreting under your statute?
The PAMI Act itself.
That's circular, though, isn't it, to say it's a federal statute, so we interpret federal law. You're asking us to interpret a record, which is really defined under the Indiana statute. What's your federal interest here?
Well, PAMI also defines record.
What's your federal interest?
That we be able to go forth and complete our duties to investigate.
Okay.
For the reasons stated above, IPASS requests that this court affirm the district court on all counts. Basically.
Thank you, Ms. Donnell. Anything further, Mr. Schaefer?
Briefly, There was an issue raised in the argument about definition of record, and that therefore this is these peer review documents or other documents are should be surrendered. When a statutory scheme is created, it creates a world to itself. If there are words in that statute that are defined, then we must follow that definition. And Section 10803 defines the term record as reports prepared by staff, blah, 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 treatment of reports prepared by an agency charged with investigating reports and injury occurring at such facilities that describe incidents of abuse, neglect, and injury. That's set out at page 18 of my brief. If we look at the in the appendix, page 84 is incident report of incident injury.
Counsel.
Excuse me. Time's up.
Counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.
All right.